Well, we want to begin a summer series in the book called Song of Songs. And if you're asking, has he lost his mind? You'll have to take a number because he's first in line asking that question. And then the other question is, how do you start a series on Song of Songs on July 4th? Stevie Wonder had an album out when I was a kid called Hotter Than July. I thought about that as a title for it, but I... No. Today is Independence Day. 245 years of, well, since we decided we're doing this thing. And it was based on the belief that we have some God-given rights. We have the right to pursue happiness. Not to be happy, necessarily, but to pursue happiness. We have the right, we have equal value in the eyes of God and in the eyes and under the law. That doesn't mean we're guaranteed equal outcomes because we're not born equally capable, but we are of equal value. That's a biblical notion that's right at the beginning of our Declaration of Independence. Historians from different perspectives agree in the reading I've been doing of late, ones that are very politically different from one another, they do agree that probably the most unified time in our country was about the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 8th. And this coming December 7th, we'll be remembering 80 years since that attack. And most of us have lived out our lives in the most unified time in our country, but we're seeing that unity regressing to a previous level of disunity. We came very nearly, very close, in the First War, the Revolutionary War, and in the Civil War just before that. We came very close to being about three, maybe four countries instead of one. And that was just the way it turned out. But when Pearl Harbor, that attack happened, people, mostly men, all over the country, because that was what men did in those days, or it was a role of men, if I could put it that way, all over the country went to their closest recruiting station to sign up for the military. We had a common enemy, and it was a very dangerous enemy. And people who, most of the people in our country at that point in history had never, probably most of them, ever left the county they were born in, let alone maybe even the town. And so they came for different reasons. They understood this United States and this independence differently. But they came and they won that war. And we became a superpower on this planet. We became the superpower of the Western world because we were sort of, well, we were the victors on one hand, but the war didn't happen in our territory. And we were able to reshape the Western world as that superpower. And so we rebuilt the two countries that were our main enemies in the East and in the West, Germany and Japan. We rebuilt them in our political and economic image. And we worked from a moral consensus. Our schools worked together with our corporations and our government. I remember having the something about the presidential physical fitness program when I was a kid in grade school. So we were out there doing jumping jacks and all kinds of things on behest and on behalf of the president, who wanted us all to be fit Americans. Schools, corporations, the government, Hollywood, Broadway, all those institutions of American life worked. I mean, they were all the same, you know, people as they are now, that have a sin nature, but there was a moral consensus, an agreement, that we work toward the positive ends that had been fought for in that World War II. And so that momentum went on for decades. But we are now in a new era, in a new time, and it is a time of disunity. And it's really going back to the disunity that was present very much since the beginning of the country, all the way up to World War II. But we're going back to that. We're regressing with new, very powerful tools. And these powerful tools, and most of us have one of these in our pockets, allow us to be part of a mob action anytime we want to from anywhere. We have a megaphone into the world, and the world has a megaphone into our ear for good or for ill. Now, the difficulty here is that on some issues, some things that we deeply trust and need to trust, things like medicine and psychology specifically, and what I'm going to talk about today, have been politicized so that the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association, even the New England Journal of Medicine, has been shifted. It was all before this was science-based, men and women practicing science-based medicine, psychology. That has all been shifted, and it's been given much more of a political and monetary motivation than it used to have. And so some of the people being targeted in this change, in this not good change, are children. And we've already seen this in the unborn being targeted for more than a generation now, and it's been a literal genocide. But now our young school children are becoming victims, and they're also becoming the excuses that we use to do wrong things. I've been having a look at a book called Irreversible Damage. It's by Abigail Schreier. She is a very well-educated Jewish woman in her early 40s, and she writes occasionally for the Wall Street Journal, and she's done an excellent research piece about the, it's called Irreversible Damage, and she's looking at the transgender craze that is seducing our daughters. Now, the whole business about transgender surgeries and that whole notion was all tied up until a few years ago with the notion of gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria is a condition where a person's psyche is out of sync with their body. With reference to the gender they are. Now, the science knows that every cell of your body is stamped. It says either male or female. That's science. Now, that is being ignored in a big, big way right now in our country, and it's beginning to be ignored by the AMA, the American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, the American Psychological Association, and they sort of set the standards for how doctors and nurses and psychologists practice their professions. And so what the whole transgender transition idea was 10 years ago even, was that there were a few, very often it was mostly boys, who struggled with this gender dysphoria, and they were sort of a on the fringe group, and we dealt with that, but they were a very, very small percentage. And then we had the onset of 2007, I believe, these little machines came out from the Apple Corporation, and they created whole new communication networks that just didn't exist before. And soon after that, we had a thing called the Affordable Care Act, and that said, well, it's only fair that in schools, if schools give hormones, and that's what birth control pills are, if schools can give those out to young girls without their parents knowing it, you have to get, you know, signed in triplicate to get an ibuprofen. But to get birth control, nobody has to know a thing about it. And those, it turns out, are very extremely powerful drugs. And so now, this, if we can do that, then it's only fair that we give hormone drugs to children who are seeking to transition their gender. So now we have this flood of girls trying to get access to the medical system, and there are ways you can find out online how to, the answers that you have to give to a medical professional to prove that you have gender dysphoria, even though you don't, so that you can get testosterone. Girls taking testosterone, and then even potentially looking for surgeries. And while she's saying it's in a sense, it's a craze that's being spun up by what's going on in these communication networks. The problem is that our medical institutions have got swept up into this thing, and so they're practicing what's called gender-affirming therapy. In other words, if a child, and I mean an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 12-year-old, comes and says, I don't think I want to be a girl anymore, you have to go with that. You, as a professional doctor or psychologist, if you're being watched and you're part of these associations, you can't say to that child and their parents, because very often they're not even with their parents, you can't say, you know, we all have thoughts like this, and we usually have to, this is what this part of time of life is for, is to kind of work through those things and figure it out as you grow up, because your body's changing very rapidly. That never gets said anymore. That's not allowed. You have to affirm. You say, yes, I can see that. Okay, let's get you started. And so you're agreeing by practice with childish whims. Now, what she's discovered in her research, and she did a lot of it, she talked to everybody. She talked to those who were having these things done, those who had had them done but changed their mind later, the parents, talked to the people who, the professionals doing this to children, and professionals who think that's a really bad idea, and all the way around the spectrum, and just lays out a pretty open case there for what's going on. And she finds that most of these young girls that are being affected by this don't really want to be boys or men, they just don't want to be women, because going through the growing up process is very difficult. Very often, there are girls who don't fit in, and growing up has always been difficult. It still is, and now it's the peer pressure on kids these days because of these machines is multiplied by about a million or more. You know, it was hard enough, you know, when hardly anybody knew you, just to go through the change of life from being a child to being an adult. But now everyone in the whole world, if somebody decides they're gonna take your picture in the locker room or in a bathroom, they can just put it on the net, and all of a sudden everybody in the whole world gets to decide whether or not you're good looking and whether or not they like what your body looks like. How's that for some pressure? And so it's getting crazy. And once you get into that realm, you're never forgiven, you're never excused, and it's in there forever. And then add to that the fact that most girls, the average age of when girls are seeing pornography for the first time is 11. And she tells me that pornography has now a very large element of violence in it. So young girls are witnessing older people engaging in sexuality, and it's violent, and they say, I don't want to grow up and do that. Why would I want to do that? I can't take this. I don't want to be a woman. And so the real problem here, now this is just a craze. I think when the backwash of people who are in their 20s suddenly realize they've been ruined for life, they come back with lawyers and start suing, some of this is going to slow down. Some people are going to start getting some common sense again. But there are no gatekeepers anymore protecting the little ones. Parents aren't even allowed to protect their children. It's very difficult. And so children get hormones at school without their parents' knowledge or permission. And if the parents find out and disagree with that, they get the mob treatment that their kids have been getting when they disagree with the, you know, what is now the establishment. Let's get you started on some male hormones, or at least we can delay the onset of your life change. And everybody in the establishment knows that these are all very powerful and potentially damaging drugs. But the motivations now are not doing the right thing. The motivations are power and money and keeping your job, because the mob can drive you out. And so that's why she titled her book Irreversible Damage. Now, this is a very different topic than opposite gender attraction, opposite sex attraction, homosexuality. That's a different topic. And we talked a few years ago about the LGBT, now LGBTQ communities. The truth is, they're not just one community, and they have very different motivations about why they're doing what they're doing, and they don't agree with each other, and they don't often get along with each other. So don't imagine that it's all just one thing. But let's think for a moment about what parenting is. Parenting is providing a safe space for children to explore what they are, who they are, and what their life's about before they take it into the marketplace. Parenting, a big part of parenting is smiling and nodding your head while your child is telling you what they want to do with their life. And you go, yeah, okay, that's fine, yeah, whatever. Because it'll be different tomorrow. And you know this. This is part of their development. But now, it's dangerous to let anyone hear your children say anything, almost, lest they be swept up into the system. Oh, this child said such and such. Well, we have to do that then. I mean, it's that crazy. You know, you're being oppressed, so let us save you from your horrible parents. So, let me stop here for a moment. How's your blood pressure? Yes, this makes me crazy too. So, the question comes to mind, is this book now left in the dust of history? Does this speak into our lives in a topic as difficult and ugly as this one that we're being faced with? Does the Bible keep pace with our progress, or should I say with our regress? We progress in our ability to do things, but those abilities have good and they have evil. We have the potential for great good, and we have the potential for great evil as well. So what do we do? Well, I would like to engage a simple poem in the Bible. It's called the Song of Songs. And it's very, on the face of it, it is, and I'll just quote here from the Moody Bible commentary, and then I'm going to follow their track on this because I like the way they approach it. They say it's a poetic presentation of a biblical view of ideal love and marriage. It's pretty simple, really. There's a woman speaking, there's a man speaking, and then there's a chorus in the background kind of singing the doo-wop parts. And it's a show. And so it's a man and a woman describing their desire for one another. And the question comes, is there extra meaning in this? And that question has been debated since the beginning, since these things were written. The rabbis and the church fathers, very early on, they both allegorized the Song of Songs. They took it to mean something else, that all these things being talked about have a different meaning, and this is describing God's love for his people, God's love for Israel, or God's love for the church, and this part of it means Jesus, and this part of it, and I'm not saying that's wrong. But their logic in that, and this is a hint, if you look at the questions in the bulletin this week at all, one of the questions is it okay that we get a poem about a man and a woman interacting in the Bible, or does there have to be a bigger reason to have such a thing? Is God allowed to put that in his scriptures? And it's a trick question. it makes it sound like it, no, it's got to mean more. No, it doesn't actually have to mean a whole lot more. It's worth it just for that. Especially now, with all this irreversible damage going on, we need a reference point, and this is a really great one. This is it's an artwork, it's an art piece. This gets read in the Jewish community, in the Sabbath. This gets read on the intermediate days of Passover. When they have, if you go to the synagogue services on the days between when you have your Seder at your house or whatever, during that week, it's read and it's understood as speaking of God's love for Israel. And the church has classically thought about it as God's love for his people. So they take their allegories different directions. And I would say in the Jewish community, they took it more of a direction that what goes on between a man and a woman in a biblical love and marriage context is a very uplifting and right thing. That's what God made it for. In the Christian church, it has more often gone down the road of being sort of a Gnostic philosophy, which says, well, whatever happens in the body is not important, but only in the spirit. But this poem is all about bodies, because that's what they're talking about in the poem. So what we'll do is we're going to listen to the poem speak to us as it is. That's what we want to do. On the face of it, it's a girl coming to be a woman and a man who is a king coming together as a married couple. So let me just start our series out here by reading the first 11 verses of the Song of Songs, and you can turn there if you'd like. The verse says, the Song of Songs of Solomon. Now when it says Song of Songs, think of the phrase King of Kings or Lord of Lords or Holy of Holies. That's a Hebrew way of expressing something that's the best. It repeats a word. So Song of Songs means Solomon's biggest hit song. That's essentially what it's saying. Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That means there's nobody higher or better than him. And that's what this song is in Solomon's repertoire. He's given us Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And so when it comes to singing in songs, this is his. And this, okay, so we start out in verse 2, and this is the bride, the bride-to-be, singing to her lover or speaking to him about him. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine, she says to him. Your ointments have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is poured out like perfume. No wonder all the girls love you. The maidens. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers, or better translated perhaps, oh, that the king would bring me into his chambers, looking forward to their wedding and marriage. And then the doo-wop girls come in. The daughters of Zion, the girls of Jerusalem sing, let us rejoice and be glad in you. Let us extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. So they're backing up what she's saying with their little chorus. The girl goes on. I am black but beautiful, O daughters of Jerusalem. She's talking back to the chorus. Like the tents of Cheder, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not gaze at me because I'm dark, because the sun has looked on me. My mother's sons, my brothers, were angry with me and made me the keeper of the vineyards. My very own vineyard I have not kept. And so in this book, as she speaks, you realize she doesn't have a dad who's looking out for her. He's probably passed away by now. She is in the care of her brothers in a shame and honor-based society and culture. Brothers are a little rougher than dads with daughters. And she makes the first metaphor here. She says, my very own vineyard I have not kept. And she's complaining about the fact that she's been working out in the sun in this vineyard that she has to take care of. Well, the fact that she has a vineyard tells you that her family does okay. But her brothers, you make sure that vineyard's good. And so she says, my own vineyard, my own body is what she means. My own feminine comportment, if I can put it that way. I'm not taking care of myself the way a young woman should. Who wants to get married? I'm all browned up from the sun, and that's not the fashion of the day. She's not saying she's of African descent. She said she spent too much time in the sun, and it's making her skin rough. But she goes on in verse 7. Tell me, the one my soul loves, where you graze your flock and where you make it lie down at noon. Why should I be as one veiled, or why should I be a mourning widow, beside the flocks of your companions? So she has to be out working. She wants to go with him where he's taking a look at how his flocks are doing and the people he's hired. And so she likens herself as one in mourning when she's without her lover. The man finally speaks back. He says, if you yourself do not know, O most beautiful among women, go out yourself in the footsteps of the flock, if you really want to come out in that rough, nasty world I work in, and graze your kids or your baby goats by the shepherd's tents, I compare you, my darling, to my mare among Pharaoh's chariots. In other words, he's not insulting her. He says, you would be a lovely thing in the midst of all the rough things out there in the workplace world. If your brothers are knuckleheads, but I know what I'm looking at, and you are lovely. That's what he's saying. Goes on. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of pearls or beads. Ornaments of gold we will make for you with spangles of silver. Don't worry about your appearance. We've got everything we need to help you make you feel like you want to feel about yourself. My shepherds and your brothers, they will be wrong for mocking you. Your jewels will set you above and apart. I already know you're above and apart. And so that's as far as we want to go with the poem this week. But let's apply it just a little before we go here. The tribal world they lived in, really wouldn't let them go other places. In the difficult part of transitioning, of finding a mate for life, it's so difficult. It was difficult then, and they had plenty of, they had arranged marriages and all kinds of things. One of my daughters said to me at one point, it's so insane. If we had arranged marriages in our world, I would let you arrange a marriage for me. That's how crazy this is all making me. But this attraction between a man and a woman, this is by design. Just like that's written into every molecule in your body, these are the chemicals that pour into your body as you're growing from a child into an adult. It's chemical, it's powerful, and that's why we need families to make places to be safe while we grow up. We need believing communities as safe places to learn and to grow, to make our mistakes, and nobody else is going to tell anybody what so-and-so said, and we're not going to put it on the internet. We're going to let you be and learn. That's what we all have the right. God wants us to have that. How can we be a light in the world with this craziness that's going on around us and with this simple poem? How can we be a light in the world, as Jesus said? Let's go back to the beginning. Who are we? We are made in the image of God. We are God's image bearers in this world. And that is a powerful thing. We have the will to do. We now, basically, we're in charge of this planet for good and for ill. And that power brings with it glory on one hand, but on the other hand, it brings it the possibility of great downfall. It's a long way down. And it brings with it temptation. I can be whatever I want to be. Well, I've got the technology. God says, I would like you to be everything that I've made you to be. That's been the project of my life, is learning to be the person that God made me to be. Sometimes I don't like what he did with me. Some people are dealt a royal flush. I was born with a pair of twos and a seven. See, you know I'm bluffing. We all have to play the hand we're dealt. Well, no, you don't. You can do this. You can become that. God says, now, this doesn't mean we're anti-technology. Not a bit. I'm very much for science. I'm just really afraid when scientists don't practice science anymore. So, God says, be all that I made you to be. Folks, this is where the Lord Jesus comes into the equation. We took that cup today. We took that bread. We need Jesus to help us live above and beyond the temptations of being powerfully made in the image of God, so that we don't get swept away in a torrent of alternative options that aren't going to let us back. He can keep us from going down one-way roads that never come back this way again, from getting into irreversible damage. Oh, whatever we do, believe me, we can be forgiven, redeemed, we can be saved. But if you're not able to have children, you've changed your life. If you're not able to have children because of what you did to yourself, and you change your mind when you get older, like 20, you know, that's an amazing thing to have done. So life is hard, just like this girl in the poem. She's got to take care of this vineyard. And she wants this man who wants her. How do I do this? How do I get to be that woman? She's working hard to survive. And she still wants to be with someone she's attracted to. And that is right and it is good. And that's how life is. Jesus, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, knows the Song of Songs. He not only knows it, he's the Lord who inspired it. He loves so deeply that these, we're going to find out that these expressions of ardor, if I can use that old word, and passion for one another, they're just a reflection. We're just catching the edge of how God feels about us and about how he feels about his creation. The book of Hebrews talks about the temple of God. Back in the Old Testament, it's got, you know, page after page after page of how to make the tabernacle, the tent, how to make the material, how to make the furniture, how to make the stuff, how to the designs, and they had to do that. They had to do that, and they had to go there. It was commanded by God. And we have to live life in this body, and we have to grow up and become adults, even though there's other alternatives. And yet, when we get to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, it says that all that work that went into making that tabernacle and all the stuff, all the sacrifices, all the animals that died for those sacrifices, they're just the edge of the reality that is Jesus entering the Holy of Holies before God himself as the sacrifice. That's the reality. It's so solid. And so when we look at this poem, we know that we're just catching the edge of what's really going on, but it's the reality that we live in. And it's a good reality. It's a glorious reality. Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he knows the Song of Songs, because in a real sense, he wrote it. He knows our hearts. He knows our life. He knows our temptations. He knows our difficulties. He's asking us to trust him with this, even though there's this incredibly big river, this torrent that wants to take us down somewhere else that never comes back. He's asking us to step back from the flood. Just don't get in that river. He's asking us to listen to the poem. It's really quite something. It makes us laugh. It makes us smile. It makes us amazed. We are human beings made in the image of God, and Jesus loves us down to the bone. Down to the place where nobody else knows us. He does. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord Jesus.